Thank you for joining us. This is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Fisheries Pod. If you're of the generous sort, you can support the podcast on Patreon. Through Patreon, you're able to support the show with either a recurring or one-time donation. If that isn't your thing, you can also purchase Fisheries Pod shirts, hoodies, stickers, and face masks on our Teespring store. I'm Zach Crum, and joining me today is Zach Moran. Zach received his bachelor's in biology from Virginia Tech, and his master's in fisheries and wildlife from Arkansas Tech University. Zach's background is in fisheries ecology and management, and he is currently a PhD student at Baylor University, where his research focuses on how alligator and long-nosed gar influence food web dynamics in the Brazos River. Welcome to the podcast, Zach.
Hi, Zach. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Always happy to have a fellow Hokie on the podcast.
Yeah, let's go.
All right. Well, awesome. So to start us off, how did you first become interested in fish, Zach?
Well, so I think that my interest in fish really started from an early age. So my parents had a little farm with a really sweet farm pond on it. And so literally every single day I would go out there and I'd be fishing. Like, my mom would look out the window when I was like 5 years old, just to make sure that, like, I hadn't drowned or anything in the pond. I'm there every single day, you know? So, but yeah, I think that, you know, those first experiences, along with, like, my parents were big outdoor lovers, man. Like, they took us on all kinds of, like, nature hikes, walks. You know, we did all kinds of nature activities, like signing me up for nature camps. They would take us to national parks, you know, things like, you know, so I really was outdoors a lot as a kid. And so I think those early experiences, accompanied with my passion for fishing and other outdoor recreation like kayaking and scuba diving, things like that, they really what made me so interested in a fish in the aquatic environment, so to speak.
Yeah, that's really cool. I'm jealous. You had a farm pond at your house.
Oh, yeah, man, it was sweet. It's like, you know, about, I don't know, an acre and a half, and just loaded with bass, bluegill, things like that.
That's awesome. I was always begging my mom to drive me out to a local pond after I got out of school. So would have been convenient just walking back there.
Yeah. And I feel like that's how a lot of people, like, how they first get into fisheries is through fishing. You know, they just, and then they're just kind of fascinated by fish, and then it just kind of goes from there. So,
yeah, especially in the basics, you know, like bluegill and bass fishing is a really great way to get kids involved and people into fishing.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. So
awesome. Yeah. So you did your undergrad at Virginia Tech, and that was in, you graduated in 2014, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. And I wasn't even a fisheries guy. I wasn't even in the fisheries and wildlife program. I was actually a biology guy. I used to want to be a veterinarian or a doctor, you know?
Okay.
Yeah. And then when I became a junior, I took a class. One of the core classes you could take was ichthyology. And I was like, you know what? Like, I've always loved fish. I've always been interested in fish. I'll take this class, you know, why not? And man, that class changed my life. So my professor, I'm sure he's a big name in fisheries. His name is Don Orth. And that guy, man, he taught me so much about fish that you could actually have a career in fisheries. And I was hooked, you know. Pun intended.
yeah,
pun intended. So he had a project studying blue catfish in the Chesapeake Bay and all the tidal rivers that went into it. And I emailed him asking him if he needed any volunteers in his lab. And he emailed back, like, yeah, for sure. We need help. Like, you know, when can you start? and so they put me to work just volunteering. I was sat in the Cheatham 127 fluvial fishes lab, just sitting there identifying catfish diet contents. And I did that for, oh gosh, almost 2 years. So it was a good time. And then after volunteering in the lab for a little bit, they hired me as a research technician. And then they put me out in the field work. And man, I'll tell you what, if you think I was obsessed with fish before that, you should have seen me after they put me on electrofishing boat, man. Like, it was nuts. And that just made it even more worse was being out there on the electrofishing boat and seeing all the fish that we would catch and stuff. So, and then, and then after I graduated Virginia Tech, I continued working for that project for another year. So
that's awesome. So your random email really kind of set up your entire career, more or less, it seems.
Yeah,
Right?
it's crazy how one email can change everything, you
It's
know.
true. Yeah, never be afraid to reach out, right?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, don't be afraid to reach out. That's for sure. So.
So from there, you kind of thought, you know, maybe general bio, I can use this and focus more on fish.
Yeah, yeah. And so that, like, so I definitely took my last remaining year at Virginia Tech to really focus on fisheries courses. So I did, I took Dr. Brian Murphy's fish management course. I took Dr. Emmanuel Frimpong's fish ecology course. I took a marine ecology course with Dr. Zhao. You know, basically anything that could, you know, make my resume more robust as far as from a fisheries standpoint. So.
Awesome. So I guess we'll kind of go back to your blue catfish project there. So for some of our listeners that are not from the East Coast or the region here in the Mid-Atlantic, can you describe what's going on with blue catfish in the Chesapeake Bay and kind of just give us a little bit more info about that?
Yeah, for sure. And I'm going to try and do one of my best friends, Dr. Joseph Schmidt. He was the PhD student on this project. I'm going to try and do him proud with this with this description. So the Chesapeake Bay is, I believe it's the largest bay or estuary in the United States, and it's the third largest in the world. And it has this enormous watershed that goes all the way from Virginia to, I believe, up to New York. And so the land that supplies this watershed is just completely dominated by agriculture and industry. And they basically use all these rivers and streams as a place to dump everything, you know. And then this was back before the Clean Water Act in the 1970s. So
right,
yeah. You're thinking like post World War II, like, you know, real booming American economy. They didn't really have any protections for water, you know, back when Lake Erie was catching on fire, you know, stuff like that. And so all these nutrients and all these chemicals just funneled into the Chesapeake Bay, and they just decimated the water quality, decimated the oyster fisheries, you know, all the seagrass beds, and it just made like just these really poor water quality environments. And as a result of that, the fish that live there also suffered. And so Virginia Department of Game and Inland Fisheries, which is now Virginia Department of Wildlife Resources, I believe, they were like, well, we want to increase angler opportunities. So what can we do? Well, they looked at different types of fish, and they saw that blue catfish might do pretty well in a muddy river system, which is how their native systems are, which is the Mississippi River drainage. And so they began a stocking program, I believe, in the 1970s, and it just was an enormous success from an introduction standpoint. I mean, the populations just exploded. They had all the food that they could possibly want, you know, food coming from the ocean and coming from upstream. And so I believe, you know, back in the 90s and the early 2000s, they were catching some really, really big blue catfish, and in high abundance too. I think the James River may be the number one or number two big blue cat fisheries on the East Coast. So that kind of, I hope that answers your question a little bit.
No, absolutely. Yeah. It's just kind of cool to hear about the story of how this sort of all began with blue cats in the Chesapeake Bay. I know I'm kind of starting to get into a project here up in the Maryland portion. So it's interesting to hear from someone that's been really involved in this work. So so you wrote a paper then after working on that project there with Dr. Orth, right?
I was a primary author on a paper looking at, we were using DNA barcoding to identify fish prey of these blue catfish. The issue with these blue, a lot of diet studies is that when fish eat fish, the it's really hard to identify at a certain point of digestion that fish prey. We called it a PDUF, partially digested unidentifiable fish. And so that can lead to, you know, you look just down at a piece of, you know, basically digested meat, and you're just like, what the heck is this?
Yeah.
You know, really no way to tell. So what I did was I took a bunch of samples and I ranked them from on a categorical scale. So with like one being least digested and three being like the most digested. And we took, you know, as much tissue as we possibly could. And we digested the tissue, we extracted the DNA from it, we amplified that DNA, and then we ran that DNA through what's called the barcode of life. So we looked at this section of the mitochondrial DNA called the cytochrome oxidase 1, and it has about 600 base pairs. And so you identify that 600 base pair sequence, you copy it, you paste it into that barcode of life database, and you click query search, And it gives you the percent chance of, hey, this could be this fish. So it's basically works the same way as a barcode does at the grocery store, essentially. So you kind of you picture like scanning a fish's DNA and it tells you what it is. So
sweet. So after you left Virginia Tech, where were you to from there?
So after I left Virginia Tech, so actually it's funny. So I worked with Blue Catfish at Virginia Tech, and man, it's crazy how timing in your career makes all the difference. There was a professor, his name was Dr. Joseph Steckel. He was also, he did his PhD at Virginia Tech as well. He was looking at blue catfish in the Arkansas River. He wanted to look at sampling efficiency, low frequency electrofishing sampling efficiency, and he wanted to look at blue catfish telemetry. And so I didn't think I had a chance of getting that position, but I applied, and lo and behold, I got it. So I moved out to Arkansas in July of 2015 is when I went out there. So
sweet. So was your transition there because of your love of blue catfish, or was it just kind of happen chance?
I think it was, Dr. Steckel, he liked guys that were very experienced in the field that they were going to study. And so he had a blue catfish project. I was an undergrad that had done a lot of blue catfish stuff, you know, and especially a lot of blue catfish sampling. And so I kind of just, I was a good fit. That you'll hear that, you know, a lot of people that are looking to get into fisheries and apply for positions, oftentimes you'll get hired, not necessarily because of your grades, but you'll be hired because you're a good fit for that position. So
talking about sampling efficiency, mm-hmm. What were you studying there in particular regarding sampling efficiency?
Okay. So, a major way that we collect fisheries managers collect blue catfish is with a method called low frequency electrofishing. Sorry. So building off of electrofishing, most electrofishing, like for bass, bluegill, things like that, they use high frequency pulses. So anywhere from 60 hertz to 120 hertz. Well, blue catfish and other ichthyoid catfishes like flatheads, they actually respond really interestingly to low frequency pulses. So anywhere from, you know, 10 or 12 hertz up to 30 hertz. And nobody's really sure why they do this. It actually would be a really cool like project to study is what are the like physiological and anatomical reasons for why catfish respond to low frequency pulses. But they do. I mean, and so what'll happen is you'll turn on the power generator, you'll turn on the box, and you'll start shocking, and about 30, 45, sometimes a minute will go by, and all of a sudden you'll just have fish, like catfish, just start surfacing all around the boat. And sometimes you can have really, really high numbers of fish come up. You can have thousands upon thousands of fish. And then you can also have times where you sample and you don't have any fish come up at all. So that really messes with your standard errors when you're analyzing your data.
Right.
Because you have one sample where it's just you catch hundreds of fish, and then you have another sample where you don't catch any. And so we wanted to figure out, okay, why is it that we're catching so many fish in certain areas, but we're not catching in any? And we decided to do that. Okay, is it environmentally related, or is it a fish biology cause? So are we catching more fish in an area because the conditions are right, or are we catching more fish in an area because the fish are actually there? So what we did was we caught a bunch of catfish, and we put acoustic transmitters in them. And we tracked them around Lake Dardanelle, which is, it's about 17,000 hectares. So it's like 35,000 acres. It's a pretty decent sized reservoir. And we tracked them, and we saw what zone of the reservoir they used, what habitats they were using, what were their movements, things like that. And then we went back through and we sampled those habitats where we used a systematic random sample design to look at all the different habitats that are available on Lake Dardanelle. And then we statistically compared our catch rates for habitats that the fish used versus the ones they didn't use, and how that linked to efficiency. And so what we were able to parcel together was that a lot of it is sampling a location where the fish actually use. You know, just like if you're going to hook and catch fish with hook and line, you're not going to catch a lot of fish if you're fishing in an area where there's no fish, right? So that was the big thing for one portion of my master's research. The other portion was looking at chase boats. So with low frequency electrofishing, you have so many fish that come up around the boat that surface, and one boat, you're just like, oh my gosh, I'm just completely overwhelmed here. I'd like, can't catch enough of these fish. Yeah. You have complete and total gear saturation. And anybody who has worked with blue catfish in the past, knows this. So a lot of people, I know, Department of Natural Resource or Wildlife Resources in Virginia, what they'll do is they'll use chase boats to kind of catch additional surfacing fish, because these fish come up, they don't just come up right next to the boat, like with high frequency electrofishing, they come up all around, sometimes, you know, 100 yards away. And if you're in an electrofishing boat, you want to keep you want to be as consistent as possible with the power that you're putting into the water. So anytime that the boat, if there's a lot of waves, you're going to cause a lot more of connection between the water and the anodes. So it's going to actually cause your power settings to kind of fluctuate. Same way, if you move the boat, you put the boat up on plane, it's going to lift those anodes out of the water. It's going to reduce the amount of surface area with your anodes touching the water. It's going to kind of, basically, it's just going to make you not as consistent with your power outputs. So that chase boat, though, that can run around and just kind of catch everything that's, you know, around you. So the question that we had was, okay, you use a chase boat, but does it actually change the size distributions of the fish that you're catching? And are you actually catching more fish when you account for the additional effort? So typically, a single electrofishing boat, it's a crew of about 3 people. Well, when you use a chase boat, it becomes a crew of about 6. So you're doubling the amount of effort for the number of fish that you're catching. So is that, you know, it's a trade-off. You know, you catch more fish, but you also increase your effort. So we wanted to really be like, okay, is it worth it, you know, to have an additional chase boat? Like, is the size distributions that you get actually different when you use a chase boat? And do you actually catch more fish when you account for that additional effort? So probably, I don't know if that made a lot of sense. I tried, but
no, I think that was great. What did you find? Was it more efficient when using an electro or a chase boat?
So, you know, catch efficiency, it really depends. So we found that at certain sizes of fish, that the efficiency really isn't really different. So especially like your stock size fish, you catch similar numbers, but, and overall the catch with using a chase boat, you know, you do catch more, but that really is a kind of a size specific thing, if that makes sense. So the chase boat will actually, because bigger fish tend to surface later and a little bit further away than the electrofishing boat, they can go out and kind of catch them. And there's also this thing, it's really weird how these blue catfish, when they surface, they don't actually just come up and stun immediately like with high frequency. They can actually get away from them. Mm-hmm. So if you're in an electrofishing boat and you see a big fish come up and you start motoring towards it, they'll actually feel the pulses as you approach and they'll dive down and get away. But the chase boat, they can actually kind of like sneak attack on those guys. They kind of come up and they can just, you know, the fish doesn't really seem aware of them when they come near. So,
okay, cool. Well, that sounds like an awesome project.
Yeah. It was a good time. I really enjoyed it. So I guess you can sum up my entire master's research with, you catch more fish if you fish where the fish are. And it really depends on what your sampling goals are as far as whether a chase boat is needed or not.
So, okay,
yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Nice, man. So was it after your master's that you worked in Puerto Rico?
Yeah. So I actually got a PhD position at Mississippi State working with a guy named Dr. Wes Neal, who's another Virginia Tech guy. He was a Virginia Tech undergrad. There's a trend here. You see how this is going?
They're everywhere.
Yeah, they're everywhere. Virginia Tech is everywhere, man. So, but he had a project in Puerto Rico studying invasive cichlids. And the project was really open-ended. You know, it was supposed to be like a ecology study on these invasive cichlids. So I went down there. I moved to Puerto Rico in August of 2017. And I was there until middle of October, 2017.
Okay. That's awesome. That sounds like a really cool experience getting to travel down there. What was it like? Cause I know that was after, was Hurricane Maria, right?
So that was actually my first trip to Puerto Rico, and that was during Hurricane Maria. I actually lived through Hurricane Maria.
Okay.
It was pretty nuts.
I knew it was 2017. I couldn't remember the month, but that's crazy.
Yeah, it was nuts. Yeah, being on the island during the hurricane, it was pretty wild.
Wow.
Yeah, it was pretty wild. So I think we had close to 140 sustained winds with gusts up to 190. You know, I mean, we were safe. I mean, you know, the biggest thing with a hurricane is just stay inside, you know, kind of hunker down and, you know, just find a safe space, safe place to kind of to hang out. And then you're just stuck there for 16 hours. And really it doesn't, you know, it the really the only part I was worried about was after the hurricanes was trying to I guess find resources. So luckily we were staying with some people that had, you know, they had a generator, we had a generator, so we were able to generate, you know, have electricity to charge phones and things like that. But you know, you just don't know in a situation like that how people are going to react as a society. And I'll be honest, everybody in Puerto Rico really came together and worked together to kind of get through this crisis. I mean, there was I didn't I don't think I saw any kind of fighting or anything while I was there. So, you know, even to get gas, you know, like, you know, you don't think about it, but after a hurricane, gas becomes one of the most precious resources down there because people need it to run cars, need it to run generators. But at the same time, like, you know, there's not a lot of gas coming in. You know, the infrastructure isn't there to communicate to tell, hey, we need gas over here. So everybody would just line up, you know, you'd wait in line for 4 or 5 hours with your gas tanks to get gas. So yeah. So but then we so Wes and a guy named Brian Haley, he and I, we went down there in I believe it was April of 2018. And we wanted to look at how all that major flooding really impacted some reservoirs down there. And Wes had a bunch of pre-hurricane data that he and some other students had collected and water quality data. And so we wanted to kind of compare and see, okay, like here's what it looked like before, what's it look like after? So we did a lot of electrofishing to collect, look at sport fish assemblages and things like that in those reservoirs. So
Okay, cool. Well, that sounds like a really great opportunity to get down there. It's
yeah,
crazy,
well,
the
it,
natural
I'm
disaster, you
yeah.
know.
Yeah, and unfortunately the funding didn't come through with that, but so I actually didn't get to finish my PhD there, but I really enjoyed the experience and I'm glad that I went. So
Okay, great. So I guess that kind of brings us to where you're at currently, because you're doing your PhD currently, right?
So I did after I left Mississippi State, I did a quick I did a, I worked for a year with a Georgia DNR's fisheries biologist. I was their cold water warm water biologist in Northeast Georgia, working with brook trout in the Appalachian Mountains, and I managed two warm water fisheries up there. And I just it just wasn't the right fit for me. And even though I loved the job and I loved working there, it just I think that for my career and my life, it just wasn't gonna just didn't work out. So I applied for a position at Baylor University, and so right now I'm working on the Brazos River, looking at fish communities in the Brazos River.
Okay, cool. So where, geographically, where is the Brazos River at in
Oh
Texas?
yeah. I guess I should have said that. So the Brazos River is the longest river in Texas. It's located in Texas, and it extends all the way almost, I believe, to Oklahoma or somewhere up there, I can't remember where exactly it starts, but it flows all the way from there across, like, almost basically it slices Texas in half diagonally, all the way up from, you know, the northwest part of Texas all the way down to Galveston.
Okay.
It's you know it's a really really interesting river system, and it's home to one of my favorite fish, which is alligator gar, lives in the Brazos River, and they're part of my research project that's going on right now. So
Awesome. So who are you working with there at Baylor?
I'm working with two guys. They're actually not fish guys. One of them they're actually one is a nutrient dynamics guy, and the other one is an ecotoxicologist, Dr. Ryan King and Dr. Cole Mattson. Brilliant guys, really, really appreciate them letting me have this opportunity to work with them. And I think the reason that they hired me was because they needed somebody to look at the fish component of the Brazos River. And so they were looking for a fish guy. And once again, I kind of fit that bill. So it's been a really, really good time down here in Texas, and we're doing some really fun research.
Cool. So yeah, more specifically in your research, what are you studying there with Gar?
The big thing that I'm looking at right now is we're looking at non-lethal sampling methods for alligator gar. So, especially for ecotoxicology and ecology studies. So, one of the things with studying, you know, large, you know, aquatic megafauna is that they're pretty rare typically. And so you want to be able to collect valuable information from them in a manner that doesn't actually kill them, because obviously you don't want to kill something that's rare. And so we're exploring the use of fin tissue and muscle plugs from these guys and looking at how they compare and contrast as far as the two things that were the response variables we're really, really looking at are mercury. So methylated mercury is the big one. And the other one is stable isotopes of nitrogen and carbon. And so that's one big thing. The other one that we're looking at is nutrient enrichment from wastewater treatment plants and slaughterhouses. And we're seeing how those nutrients, how they actually impact the fish community that's in the Brazos River. So,
okay, great. That sounds like an awesome project.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. I'm really enjoying it. So, you know, there's some seasonal components to it, you know, so it's a lot of work, but we're getting through it step by step. So,
yeah, getting to handle alligator gar, it could be worse, right?
Oh man, they are absolutely an incredible fish. The first one, so we've caught them. The biggest one we've actually netted was 8 feet and an inch long.
Oh, geez.
Yeah, and you know, and what you can't tell from pictures is that they're big around. The girth on these things is amazing. I mean, you can hardly put your arms around them, and they're absolutely gorgeous. They're absolutely gorgeous. They have these like so they're covered in these ganoid scales that are just they're hard as diamonds. I mean, the Native Americans would actually take the skin from these guys and they would use them as armor plates. Like that's how tough these things are. And
that's crazy.
Yeah, isn't that crazy? And they're beautiful. Each of those scales has like a little black like vermiculation on it. And they almost look like when you see these fish, they almost look like leopard pattern, like leopard spots. It's really, really, it's really, really pretty. And unless you are up close and see one, you don't really, you know, appreciate it, you know, from a picture. So
yeah, that's awesome. Well, I'm pretty sure Jeremy Wade went after alligator gar at one point.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And, you know, after he did that, they kind of became a bucket list fish for a lot of people. You know, it's like, you know, here, you know, I think that alligator gar were seen as sort of just this nasty trash fish. There was a paper that was published down in South Texas. I can't remember where exactly, but, you know, it said that basically the paper said that alligator gar eat a lot of largemouth bass and so people are like, oh, they eat largemouth bass. These fish are terrible. They're eating all the bass.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that's kind of a short sight, you know, so to speak, because you think about it, like if you have a bass fishery, one of the best things you can do for a bass fishery is kind of decrease the population size because then it frees up resources and your fish grow faster.
Exactly. And
yeah, you know, anybody that does fisheries management kind of understands that. And so alligator gar are kind of thinning out your population. They're eating, you know, the slow moving weak bass, and they're leaving the healthy strong bass there. So they're actually helping your bass population out. But the other thing is that alligator gar are also an opportunistic predator. And so they're going to eat what is the most available and the most abundant in your ecosystem. So if you have a lake that has nothing but largemouth bass in it, of course they're going to eat largemouth bass, right? I think it makes sense.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's such a common misconception with people, it seems, that, oh, fish are being killed, you know, it's bad, but that's, you know, we obviously know that that's not the case, so.
Yeah. And so, anyway, they kind of, you know, earn this, they've been stigmatized as this trash fish, as this bad fish, but, you know, that couldn't be further from the truth. They're an absolutely incredible fish. And now people, there's a really large recreational fishery for them in Texas. And, you know, they're actually pretty profitable. If you're an alligator gar guide in Texas, you can make some serious money if you're a good one. So, yeah, you know, I think that, again, these fish are highly stigmatized and people need to kind of understand that they're important for your ecosystem just as much as bass are.
Yeah. Yeah. All about having an appreciation for some maybe atypical fish species is a big deal, right?
Yeah, for sure. So,
all right. So some of the people I've had on the show so far have had some pretty crazy stories come out of the fieldwork that they've done. Are there any particularly exciting or unexpected events that have happened in your fieldwork so far in your career?
Yeah. Oh my gosh, man. The number of stories I could tell you would literally fill a book. I mean, there's the typical, you know, running from storms. You got boat motors and get it blowing up and getting boats and trucks stuck. I guess the hurricane in Puerto Rico is a pretty crazy story. I mean, there's just so many. But I think one that the most unexpected story was one that happened to me when I was just finished at Virginia Tech. It was the winter of 2015. And the PhD student, Joey Schmidt, and one of the other guys, Jason Emmel, and I, we were out on the James River, and we were collecting blue catfish. It was in the middle of winter. And in the bottom of the boat was just like completely covered in ice from, like, you know, we would throw fish in the live wells and the fish would splash and get water all over the bottom of the boat. And then you had a little bit of rain coming in. And so the bottom boat was just slick with ice. And what we were doing is we were back in this warm water discharge, and we were high frequency electrofishing blue catfish for this diet study. And what'll happen when you're high frequency blue catfish in these areas is you'll hit them, they'll come up for a second, and then they'll dive underneath the boat. And then you'll turn the boat around and the fish will be floating up, you know, behind you, because they swim down, they still get knocked out, but they just kind of hang below the boat for a second. And so that happened. We had about, I don't know, 25, 30 pound fish. We knocked it out and we turned around and it was floating there. And my boss, Joey, drove the boat up next to it and I missed the net job, you know? So the fish kind of was floating to the side of the boat. I was like, oh crap. So I jump down and I get on the side of the boat and I go to net the fish. I net the fish and I throw it in the live well. And as I turned around to get back up on the bow of the boat, another fish surfaced right next to us. And it was a really big fish. It was like a 50, 60 pounder. And my boss, Joey, goes, oh, there's another one. And so he guns the motor, turns the wheel at the same time. And my feet slip on the ice. And I smack my mouth against the corner of the bow of the boat right there. And it knocked three of my teeth out.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, knocked three of my teeth out. Oh. So I get up, you know, Jason's netting the fish, and I get out and I'm like spitting teeth into my glove. And I look at the Joey, I was like, Joey, my teeth. And he looks at me, he goes, oh my God. And he turns the motor off and we just sit there and I'm just like picking teeth out of my mouth. And of course, those guys, you know, they were like my brothers, and they look at me and they go, you know what we can call you now? He's like, we can call you Fish and Chips. And Jason says, yeah, we call you Fish and Chips or Chips Ahoy. So, but yeah, no, that's probably my most unexpected fieldwork story on top of all the other ones. But it's pretty funny. It's funny now.
That's funny. I was reading through some of Joey's papers for sort of a literature review for my project. And in one of them, I know he mentions, he acknowledges some of those for helping out. And he says, often less than desirable field conditions. And now I really know what he was talking about there.
Yeah, that's exactly what he was talking about. And then they joke about, you know, we're such nerds, you know, we were joking about, oh yeah, your Zach's feeding efficiency has been decreased. that's probably one of the biggest ones I have. So
yeah, you really never know what's going to happen out there. It's funny.
Yeah, you have to be careful, you know, you got to be safe, you know, you can't, don't, if you're electrofishing, do not get off the bow of the boat, even if it is to net a fish. Stay up there, stay somewhere where you can, don't have a risk of falling off the boat or falling in.
Yeah, it's not worth it, right?
Yeah, so.
Great. So what advice would you give to undergraduate students, or maybe those that are kind of just starting off in fishery science?
Oh, okay, that's an excellent question. I guess the advice I would give to undergrads comes from myself is the first thing is you're not doing this job for the money. If you want to make money in your career, do not go into fisheries. No, I'm serious.
No, it's the truth.
Yeah, it's the truth. It's the harsh truth. But you study fish because you love nature, you love the environment, and you find fish fascinating. The other advice I would give undergrad students is, don't be afraid to reach out. You know, an email can change everything. I mean, in my experience, you know, I had times where I was like, well, maybe I'll get it, maybe I won't, and I would apply and I wouldn't get it, and that would suck. But then there would also be times where I would apply and I would get it. So you got to be willing to put yourself out there, and you can't be afraid of failure. Otherwise, you're just going to be sitting there spinning your wheels, never accomplishing anything.
Right.
And then the other thing is get engaged. You know, a lot of universities will do like fisheries field days. They'll have sampling opportunities. You know, contact your professors, look and see what their research is. You know, put yourself out there and really, you know, apply yourself towards, you know, finding these opportunities. It'll be worth it. Trust me.
So. Great. Yeah, I think that's really good advice. So yeah, we'll go ahead and get into our final five questions here. So to start us off, what is your favorite fish?
Whew. All right. This is a tough one because I have a lot of favorite fish. But I'll go ahead and I'll kind of respond to this as telling you what my favorite current fish is. I would have to say that it's, you know, it's an alligator gar. You know, basically you have this fish that's been swimming around since the age of dinosaurs. You know, they got these, they're huge. They got, you know, really cool, like cool life history traits. You know, they're covered in pseudoarmor. They got giant teeth. But you know, what else is really interesting about them is that they're really important ecologically. You know, picture them as kind of the guys that clean up everything and inside. They're the trash man of society. You know, without them, you'd have a bunch of dead floating fish carcasses, and you'd have a lot of really sick, overcrowded fish populations. And so these guys really come in, and without them, you'd have a much less healthy ecosystem. So,
yeah, that's a good one. They're crazy prehistoric beasts. So I think that's definitely a fair answer there.
Yeah, you know, you look into the eyes. You know, that's what. You know, I remember when I, for the very first one I saw, we netted it and I brought it in the boat, and you just look into this eye, and it honestly, like, you're scared. Like it's an eye that you've never seen before. You know, it just is something from a different time. And unless you've really seen these fish up close, you don't kind of get that perspective. So especially the really big ones, the really big fish, they're just something completely entirely different than anything you've experienced.
So. Man, you're making me want to come out to Texas.
Well, come on out, man. We'll go catch some alligator gar. I need the help. I need the help.
All right. So what, for question two, what is your favorite memory from your career so far?
Oh man, this is another tough one. Cause again, there's so many, and it's honestly, there's too many to pick a favorite, but I think, you know, one of the things that you hear of in this, this career is you don't get paid a lot, you know, monetarily, but you get paid in sunrises and sunsets. And, you know, I think I've seen some of the most beautiful sunrises and most beautiful sunsets when working in fisheries. You know, one in particular was over the James River. It was in the middle of January. It was dead calm, no wind. Water was like a mirror. You could just see the sun just setting. It was just like the whole entire sky was just an explosion of orange, you know, reds and oranges. And then I think another one I have is was backpack shocking in Northeast Georgia and the Clear Mountain streams up there for brook trout. And a crew of tiny people walking among these giant hemlocks and forests of rhododendron, and you catching these little teeny tiny brook trout that have, you know, adapted to survive in these, you know, headwater streams. They're just absolutely beautiful, scarlet red in color. You know, another one I have is probably shocking the Arkansas River, you know, having thousands of blue catfish coming up and surfacing around the boat. literally thousands. I mean, I'm not making that up. You know, being in Puerto Rico and shocking in the jungle, electrofishing in the jungle, and having peacock bass jumping around you and red devil cichlids just bright orange flashing all around. And you know, working, you know, here in Texas, you know, seeing my first alligator gar, you know, having that fish come up and just having the hairs on my arm literally stick up in the back of my neck stick up, because it's just such a, you know, amazing fish. So yeah, there's just too many favorite memories.
Too many to pick one. Yeah, that's awesome.
I can't do it. I wish I could, but I can't.
No, that's really cool. It's amazing. I think I'm going to put that on a t-shirt. You get paid in sunrises and sunsets. I never have thought about that, but it's true.
Yeah. You get paid in sunrises and sunsets. So.
That's really cool. I'm definitely fortunate to be working in the field that we do. And why it's so cool to be able to talk about this with so many different people and get these stories out, you know, so that people that even aren't in the field of fisheries can hear about what it's all about and the magic of it all. So
yeah, absolutely.
Excellent. So what is your dream job and location?
So my dream job would be to be a professor in fisheries ecology or fisheries management, something to do with fisheries. But I really love to teach. I really want to be that positive influence that I received when I was an undergrad. You know, I want to be kind of the guy that teaches people about how important fisheries are and just how dynamic and beautiful this whole thing is. And then I'd also like to, you know, write grants and do research. So, and this is going to sound kind of cliche, but I honestly would love to make it back to Blacksburg, go teach at Virginia Tech.
Yeah. Yeah. No, making it back to Blacksburg would not be the worst thing to happen, right?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So.
Great. Well, that's really cool that you have had such a great influence and kind of want to share that love of biology and fish with others in the form of being a professor. I think that's a really good answer.
Yeah.
So then if money was not an issue, what is one project you'd like to work on?
Oh, that's a great question. And that's one they actually just asked me on my comprehensive exams a couple weeks ago. So
Okay, yeah.
actually, I was fortunate. I have a couple of responses for that. One of the questions actually I'm fascinated by is what these alligator gar, and that is that they actually have a pretty high saltwater tolerance. And there's really well-documented cases of them actually going out into saltwater. In fact, my advisor, Dr. Mattson, he caught a 4-foot alligator gar in the surf while he was red fishing, which is really, really interesting. And so that kind of, I kind of had this question. It's like, okay, like these fish don't have any issues with going out into the ocean. Where do they go? And so I wanted to look at stable isotopes of oxygen in these fish to kind of determine like where, and that, and along with a trace element analysis to kind of determine, okay, what part of their life stage do they go in and out of from freshwater to saltwater, and then maybe even add a telemetry component to them and seeing how far offshore they go. Can they go to different rivers? Because the Trinity River and the Brazos River, they're pretty far apart. But if an alligator gar really, really wanted to, they might be able to, move in between the two of them. So that's just an interesting question that I have. And then what was the other one that I wanted to look at? The other one I wanted to look at was also with alligator gar, but it pertained to a mercury, and that was to look at the entire Brazos River from top to bottom and see how mercury kind of do a river continuum study, but also look at mercury in the food web and seeing how that kind of shifts as you go from up here near Waco. And does it decrease in fish tissues and alligator gar as it gets down towards Galveston? So those were the two questions that I kind of had.
Yeah, those are great. I knew that alligator gar had some salinity tolerance, but I had no idea they would go out like that fully into the Gulf there. That's crazy.
It's pretty wild. And and I wouldn't have believed it either, but my advisor, he sent me a picture. He's like, "You not believe where I just caught this fish." And so that's, I don't know how long they stay out there for. I don't know, maybe it's like when you have a lot of floods that happen and there's like a kind of a like a lot of dilution from freshwater kind of pushes everything out. Maybe that's why they go out there. But yeah, no, that's it's really cool that they do that.
Yeah, those would be two really good studies and extremely useful. So, going over to our last question here. So, if there was one point or principle that you could have programmed into everyone's head, all of our listeners, what would it be?
I would say that caring about the environment matters, and a lot of people doing little things can have big impacts. Too oftentimes, we kind of, I feel, especially me, like you look at how many people are out in the planet, and you kind of, and you see, as an ecologist, you kind of see how we negatively impact, natural systems. And it's depressing, but I think that if we can kind of get a lot of people on board to be like, okay, I may not be able to do much, but even if it's just like turning off your lights at night, or when you leave the house, or turning your AC down, or recycling, plastic, little things like that, can make big changes. But, Earth is, the planet that we live on, Earth, it's effectively an island floating through the vast emptiness of space, right? And we really need to get this idea through our heads that it matters, and that we need to conserve and protect, everything, all just this the beautiful ecosystems that are here. So I think that's what I would try to get everybody on board with, so to speak.
Yeah, that's great. Wow. It is crazy. People think, oh, I don't need to recycle. I'm not only one person here, and it's not going to make a difference what I do, but I think you're right. It really does. Even the little things add up over time, and they turn into really big things. So that's great. All right, Zach. Well, I really appreciate you coming on the show. It was awesome getting to hear about some of the amazing stuff that you've worked on and all over the country and even a territory outside of the US. So I've really enjoyed it. So I wanted to thank you again.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Really appreciate you having me on the podcast. I enjoyed it a lot.
Sweet. So if our listeners would like to get in contact with you, what's going to be the best way to do that?
You can contact me probably best through email. I don't know how to provide that to people, but probably through email.
Okay. Well, yeah, I've got your email and I'll just put it in the show description so they can just find it there if they'd like to send you an email.
Yeah, absolutely.
If you'd like to get a hold of us at the Fisheries Podcast, you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram at Fisheries Pod, or by email at feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. You can download past, present, and future episodes on your favorite listening app, or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. And don't forget, you can help support the podcast with a monthly contribution through Patreon or by rocking some awesome Fisheries Podcast logo merch available on Teespring. I'm Zach Crum, and thank you for listening to the 144th episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember, small changes in how you live your life can go a long way in protecting the environment.